and welcome to Alzheimer's Speaks Radio. I'm your host, Lori LeBay, and I'm so excited that you're joining us today. We are going to have a fascinating conversation, as usual, as we learn from people all around the world at all ages and stages of life. Stay tuned as we shift our dementia care from crisis to comfort.
Here we go. What you think about?
Well, hi, everyone, and welcome back to Alzheimer Speaks. I'm thrilled you are joining us today. We are going to have an interesting conversation. As always, we're going to be talking with a diagnostic company with the vision to bring clarity through innovation through their company and regarding blood tests and dementia. So I can't wait to dive a little bit deeper on this. But before we go there, I always like to give a couple of shout outs. So one is I'm a big fan of memory cafes. I do one myself, which is virtual. And anyone is welcome to join Arthur's Senior Care Memory Cafe. We meet the second and the fourth Wednesday of each month from about 1 to 3 virtually. You can just reach out to me at radio@alzheimersspeaks.com. And that 1 to 3 is Central Time. Also, if you're in Minnesota, I do another group, which is called Caregiver Connect. And that meets at the Shoreview Community Center here in Minnesota. That also has respite. We meet the last Wednesday of each month from 10 to 11:30. And again, you can just reach out to me with information and I will get you details and so forth on that. And then I always like to encourage people to go to our website, alzheimerspeaks.com. We have a ton of free educational resources. Please take advantage of them. Please share it with others. That's why they're there. We want to make it easy. My own mom lived with dementia for 30 years, and I get what it's like to be a family caregiver as well as a professional looking for services, products, and tools. So just click on that free educational tab. We also have a wonderful children's book that actually is great for all ages called Betty the Bald Chicken, Lessons in How to Care. And you can access that on the book tab. Also with that book, I should mention it's not dementia specific, so it could be used for bullying and divorce and chronic illness and addictions and all those times we just don't feel like things are clicking in our lives and we don't fit in or don't belong. It really is a great way to have a simple conversation. And then last, I would encourage you to go to Dementia Map, which is our global resource directory. It has over 150 categories you can search. It's got wonderful blog articles, glossary of terms, and a calendar of events. And there's no charge for that. We're not going to ask for any of your personal information. We just want to ease the process. And if you are a vendor with a service, product, or tool, we'd love to have you be part. There's both a free and paid plans that you can participate in there. Again, just go to dementiamap.com, and I would also be glad to give you a tour of that. With that, let's get on to our guest. Dr. Bronstein, I am so excited to have you with us today. There's so much going on in the industry right now. I think it's really exciting times for dementia. My own mother, I don't know if you know this, lived with it for 30 years. And that's kind of what bounced me into this arena, was to try to raise voices and connect people to services, products, and tools. And it sounds like you're doing some pretty exciting things. So I'd like you, if you don't mind, to introduce yourself and your company and what you're up to a little bit, and then we'll dive into our questions.
Sure, Lori. Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure to be here today and speak to you about C2N Diagnostics and myself and my own personal journey for getting here. But it is an exciting time in the field. So just a little bit of background about myself. I am trained as a cardiovascular specialist. When I was involved with academia and thinking about the issues afflicting individuals with heart disease, one of the key issues for me was always about how can we prevent the disease. And over time, I became increasingly interested in how From a macro perspective, the system can implement processes and new technologies to improve the lives of people with cardiovascular disease and ways we can prevent the disease. And I kind of feel like the field of cardiovascular medicine, while it remains a significant problem today, has really experienced a revolution with regard to the new technologies that can prolong people's lives and have both longer lives as well as higher quality living. And I said, well, wouldn't it be exciting to be able to see the same kind of advances and transformation of neurological diseases, particularly Alzheimer's, which is something that touches all of us at one point or another in our lives. Just by my own, you know, personal experiences, I do have certain family members through marriage and even within my own family, where people have been afflicted with dementia. And frequently, you know, the question that comes back is, well, was it actually Alzheimer's disease? And oftentimes dementia is not specifically diagnosed. Perhaps there's maybe ambivalence about exactly what the specific cause of the dementia is. And perhaps maybe the feeling that there's not as much that one can do about the dementia. So one tries to think about ways to make that person's quality of life and remaining time to be something that they can handle as well as possible, but without really giving specific answers. And I think that clearly, as we see innovation and the field evolving towards more precision medicine, which we've seen in the field of cardiology as well as oncology, you know, we're starting to see those early signs of success with neurodegeneration and Alzheimer's disease, that makes it an extremely exciting time, because now, instead of giving that diagnosis of dementia, we can get more specific and we can start talking about exactly what's the underlying cause of the dementia, and then recognize that, in fact, there are ways to potentially intervene on the disease and slow the progression of the disease in a way that will translate to improvements in patient care. So, I became involved with C2N Diagnostics as early as 2007, which is when the company started. And I was introduced to professors David Holtzman and Randall Bateman out of the Washington University School of Medicine. At the time, I was working with a colleague, Ilana Fogelman, who her and I had been working together on some new technology development and ways to better understand more efficient ways of delivering technology for healthcare, particularly in the area of biotechnology. And I was introduced to Professors Holtzman and Bateman through a mutual colleague, Harlan Krumholtz, actually, and who's a professor at Yale. And you know, from that time, you know, to where we are today, it's been an extremely rewarding and really extraordinary degree of innovation that has brought us to where we are today, where we now have actually, you know, very practical solutions to be able to both diagnose as well as now start treating the disease.
Well, that is exciting. I know, you know, for my mom, it took 10 years for her to actually get a diagnosis. You know, she was told, you know, and this was a long time ago, she's been gone since 2014, and lived with the disease 30 years, but she was just told it was her hormones over and over and over. And she like knew from talking to her girlfriends, it was different, but you know, there was just no way to really tell, you know, unless you want to have an autopsy. And, you know, she was still quite happy living her life, you know, with that. So that wasn't about to happen. So it's interesting to see the new things coming out. Now, you are doing some blood tests called Precivity. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-494-8310. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-494-8310. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now, 800-494-8310.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Sure. So, you know, to where we are today with regard to some of the testing that we can provide in blood, the Precivity test, and we have multiple different forms of the test that we can get into in a little bit. But the first generation test that we introduced to the market in 2020, test known as Precivity AD, actually had its origins dating back as early as 2007. And so it took us about 13, 14 years to be able to actually advance the technology and our understanding of the disease to the point where we could actually start measuring these markers that are indicative of what's happening in the brain to a level of precision and accuracy that could be translated to true clinical care and helping patients. The company's roots are really based around an analytical platform known as high-resolution mass spectrometry. And mass spectrometry is a very powerful research tool that is a well-accepted approach to protein discovery and understanding other biomolecules in the body. And early on, some of our collaborators from Washington University School of Medicine had really been looking into the use of mass spectrometry proteomics to be able to start measuring some of these markers. When we started C2N Diagnostics in 2007, we developed some very, very high quality assays for cerebral spinal fluid, which can be accessed through lumbar punctures, not the necessarily preferred modality for a lot of individuals because of the invasiveness of it. But what we learned over the course of 13 years based on doing some of those high precision medicine measurements, we realized that there are ways to take some of those methods that we had optimized in CSF to then start applying towards analytical measurements within the blood. And so in 2016, 2017, we started to see early progress. Some of that work was originally unveiled at one of the major medical meetings by Professor Randy Bateman, where he really showed for the first time to the world that one can actually use mass spectrometry to measure amyloid beta particles. These amyloid beta peptides are integrally associated with the formation of amyloid plaques, which are one of the core pathological findings of any individual with Alzheimer's disease. And so the ability to actually uniquely measure those markers in the plasma became of incredible interest to the field. And it really spawned a lot of additional innovation that, you know, over the last 6-7 years has been really nothing short of astonishing, whereby we can now measure these amyloid particles with an extremely high degree of precision and accuracy within the blood. And then we can also look at other markers such as the tau protein and fragments of the tau protein that we also know are implicated in Alzheimer's brains, the neurofibrillary tangle, or tau tangles, as they are commonly referred, is another core pathological finding of anyone who's been afflicted with Alzheimer's disease. So C2N has been really focusing on these measurements in blood, and the Precivity AD test originated from our unique understanding of disease biology and also the ability to use these high-quality analytical systems like mass spectrometry and other methods to focus on those specific analytes that ultimately translate into a blood test that can be offered for patients.
So we've got the three, and I want you just to highlight those again, because you had mentioned the spinal fluid. Is that one of them then through the spinal fluid?
So that's a great question. So we actually do offer some testing using cerebral spinal fluid. However, that's exclusively for research applications. We really have been innovators in the field to try to bring blood biomarkers to the forefront of clinical care. And so the three tests that we offer today for patient care are actually exclusively focused on blood. And the first test, as we briefly discussed, is known as the Precivity AD test. We introduced that test in 2020. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. We then more recently, in the summer of this past year, we introduced the test known as Precivity AD2. And we also introduced a test known as Precivity ApoE. And so ApoE is short for apolipoprotein E. It's it's a very important protein that has been that plays an essential role in the metabolism of lipids, and also even a carrier for molecules that are associated with lipids, and that happens to include amyloid and tau. And so we know that there are certain apolipoprotein E is a protein is made by genes. We know that there's specific genetic variants of apolipoprotein E that are really the strongest genetic risk factors for sporadic Alzheimer's disease. And when people often talk about Alzheimer's disease running extensively in their family, they're oftentimes referring to likely someone in that family, or maybe many individuals in the family, carrying what we call the ApoE4 allele, which is one variant of the apolipoprotein E protein that has a propensity for leading to or contributing to the accumulation of amyloid. And so we know that that elevates a person's risk for ultimately developing the disease. So the Precivity AD test actually is a blood test. It was the first one we introduced in 2020. It uses a single blood collection tube. So these purple top tubes that people are used to providing when they go to their clinician and they have to get routine labs. We draw a small amount of fluid from those from that blood, and we isolate the blood into certain fractions known as plasma. There are other components, but we focus on the plasma that's part of the blood, and the plasma is ultimately brought back to the laboratory at C2N Diagnostics, which is located. We have a large clinical testing lab based out of St. Louis, Missouri. And that testing, the samples arrive into the lab, and then the testing is processed for ultimately a readout of the amyloid beta 42/40 peptide levels. We express it as a ratio, the A beta 42/40 ratio. We combine that with the apolipoprotein E measurement that we briefly talked about in the Precivity ApoE test. So we look at the ApoE forms that a person has, and there are a variety of different forms. And we know that the ApoE4 allele will confer that higher risk. We combine the A beta 42/40 ratio with the ApoE protein forms, and we combine it with age into a validated algorithm that will provide a measurement that we term the amyloid probability score. And that amyloid probability score is a simple measure that is reported on a scale from 0 to 100. And the higher the score, the more likely it is that an individual has amyloid plaques in the brain. And we've done extensive studies to show that this APS measurement is closely associated with the presence or absence of amyloid plaques. And so when we report out the values of the APS or the amyloid probability score, we report it as a low likelihood, an intermediate likelihood, or a high likelihood of amyloid plaque presence. Now, the second generation test is in some ways similar because it's known as the Precivity 82 test. And instead of reporting out what we call the APS or the amyloid probability score, in this case, we actually report out the APS2. And so it's amyloid probability score 2. Again, it's scored on a scale from 0 to 100. And instead of measuring the values that I referred to that comprise the Precivity AD test, which again, as a reminder, is A beta 42/40 ratio plus the ApoE genotype plus age to predict or to provide this value known as the APS. In the case of the Precivity 82 test, what we measure is the A-beta 42-40 ratio, just like the first generation, but we're also measuring two unique tau peptide fragments. One is known as the phosphorylated form of tau at a specific site on the tau protein, which we call 217. It's the threonine 217 site. So we call that for short the p-tau 217 value. And then we also measure the non-phosphorylated tau fragment at the same 217 site. So we express the percent, the p-tau ratio as the phosphorylated tau at the 217 site over the non-phosphorylated tau at the 217 site. And that's expressed as what we call the percent p-tau ratio. So we combine the percent p-tau ratio with the A-beta 4240 ratio into this validated algorithm to produce the APS2 score. The APS2 score is, again, on a scale of 0 to 100. And in this case, the diagnostic performance of that test is so good that we can actually just use a single cutoff value. So we report the result out as positive or negative. And when we say positive, that means that, again, there's a high likelihood of amyloid plaque pathology. And if it's negative, then that means a very low likelihood of amyloid plaque pathology. And then that can help the clinician now have very informative, quantitative data to help make a better assessment of the patient's health condition.
Okay. I'm going to just give a shout out, because if people are just tuning in right now, you might want to rewind a little bit to hear all we've been talking about. Fascinating testing that is able to be done now for dementia. We are talking with Dr. Braunstein, who is the CEO and president of C2N Diagnostics. And they have just some great testing, which is done by blood tests, which is, you know, I mean, we're all used to getting our finger pricked and blood drawn. So not too invasive, which is really sweet. And you can always go to their website to learn more. And that is at precivityad.com, precivityad.com. They are also on Twitter as C2N Diagnostics, and same on Facebook as C2N Diagnostics. But again, a fascinating conversation. I've got a couple of questions for you. One is, when these tests are done, does the doctor pick like one, or do they do all three of the tests at one time? How does that work?
Yeah, Lori, that's a wonderful question. So, to recap, we have the Precivity AD test and then the Precivity AD2 test. And then we have this other measurement called Precivity ApoE. And so when we talked about the Precivity AD test, that includes the A-beta 42-40 ratio plus ApoE. So that right there, when we report out those results, means that the person who is receiving the test result will not only have the measurement called the APS that helps inform on the likelihood of amyloid plaques, but they're also getting a report of their ApoE gene status. And so therefore, there would never be a need for getting both the Precivity AD test as well as the ApoE, the Precivity ApoE test. Now, the story is a little bit different in the case of the Precivity AD2 test, which is our second generation test to identify Alzheimer's disease pathology using blood. And so in that case, as you know, the two measurements that are included in that Precivity 82 test result include the A-beta 42-40 ratio and then the percent p-tau 217 ratio. And both of those markers, the p-tau markers as well as the amyloid beta 42-40 markers, are very powerful indicators of the likelihood of amyloid pathology and also to some degree tau pathology, like tau tangle pathology in the brain. But that does not tell you whether or not you have the APOE4 allele, which confers elevated risk for developing Alzheimer's disease. Now, APOE4 plays another important role, not just in identifying a person's potential future risk of disease. It's actually proven in multiple different studies for all these emerging disease modifying therapies. So we're starting to see the fruits of labor from all the innovation and investment that has occurred from biopharmaceutical companies, and many of whom are our partners, who have been developing these anti-amyloid therapies. And they're able to demonstrate that when you administer these drugs to individuals with Alzheimer's disease pathology, that you can actually start to rewind that clock, where you start to remove those amyloid tangles or those amyloid plaques. And so by removing the amyloid plaques, we know that when you start to remove them from the brain, that will actually translate to an improvement in clinical outcome for the patient. That's pretty extraordinary. That's taking like fundamental biology that the field has been working on for 20 to 30 years and saying, if there's a way that we can target amyloid, which we know is a bad actor that's contributing to Alzheimer's disease biologically, if we can now introduce an agent that can remove the amyloid from the brain, can we actually improve the patient's clinical condition? And the answer is yes, you can. Now, these drugs do not, reverse a person's memory decline. At least the current evidence today doesn't show that, although there are additional studies ongoing that may show some additional data down the road that makes us think otherwise. But today we see that these drugs can slow the progression of disease. And by slowing the progression of disease, that translates to longer functional independence and kind of, you know, overall health benefit for the patient longer while they're in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease. Now, back to the APOE story, because it turns out that individuals who are carriers for the APOE4 gene, that there's pretty clear associations of that gene, specific gene type, APOE4 allele, conferring a higher risk of potential complications from receiving those disease-modifying therapies. And so the concern are these microhemorrhages or microbleeding, known as a condition called amyloid-related imaging abnormalities, or otherwise known as ARIA. And so we know that people who carry the APOE4 allele are at a slightly higher risk of experiencing these microbleeds in the brain when they're administered these anti-amyloid therapies. And it turns out that if in fact one carries two copies of the APOE4 gene, then they're at about two times the risk of having a higher likelihood of experiencing, you know, one of those complications. Now, the good news about ARIA is that it's something that requires careful monitoring and understanding whether or not it occurs at all in the patient who's now getting these disease modifying therapies. And then frequently those changes are reversible once you stop the drug. And infrequently, very infrequently, do they lead to something that's more concerning or very significant in terms of bleeding. But because of the fact that the ARIA is associated with the APOE4 allele, now all of a sudden you can imagine a very significant clinical need for a clinician and a patient who might be considering going on one of these disease-modifying therapies to also know their APOE4 status, because what it informs is whether that person might be at a slightly higher risk of a complication and therefore warrants more close follow-up. I mean, any patient who goes on these drugs requires careful follow-up with their clinicians, but we know that certainly an individual who carries those APOE4 genes, you know, needs even more careful assessment. And sometimes the clinician may actually decide that the patient's not appropriate to go on the disease-modifying therapy. At the end of the day, whenever we make decisions in clinical medicine, and this is not just related to whether or not we make a decision to treat, it's also making a decision of whether to test. You know, one has to evaluate the risks and the benefits. And so oftentimes it's a risk-benefit analysis. And I think it's clear that the benefit exceeds the risk in the case of having these fully FDA-approved drugs now emerging on the market. But it may not necessarily be for everyone, right? And so that's where the power of having precise testing comes into play, that now, in fact, you have more healthcare information. In this case, we can provide the APOE data, and we can also provide, a very high quality test that will help inform on the status of the amyloid presence in the brain. And there are other modalities like cerebrospinal fluid analysis or amyloid PET scans that are obviously well-established approaches to looking at amyloid in the brain. So when having these tools allows the clinician to make a much better decision for the patient, working with that patient as a partner. And I think that this really comes back kind of almost like full circle to how we began this conversation today, where you said, well, we all know someone who might have had a loved one who had this nonspecific diagnosis of dementia. And we say, well, might there have been some ambivalence in the past to really getting to the core understanding of what's causing the dementia? And I think we're now at a point in the history of, medicine and in clinical care for these patients, where it's very clear that having more precise information than just saying a general diagnosis of dementia, that we need to understand the underlying root causes of the dementia, because there are, in fact, things that we can do, based on what happens to be that cause. So in the case of Alzheimer's disease, it accounts for about 60 to 80% of all dementia. But we know that, that also means 20 to 40% of people who are experiencing dementia or cognitive concerns don't actually have Alzheimer's at all. And so when we have these tools, it can help improve our diagnostic accuracy at the clinician level for them to say, well, when I look at all the totality of the evidence and the tests that I've run on you maybe over the last couple of weeks or a couple of months, I think that we can be confident that you don't have Alzheimer's disease, or in fact, you do have early stage Alzheimer's disease. And now let's start talking about what we can do about it. So that's we're at a unique time in history where we can start having those conversations.
I'm just a little, I get a little confused with the amyloid plaque thing. And you had mentioned that, there's medication that can, if that is assessed, that's part of the issue, to get rid of that and improve that. But if I'm not mistaken, the Nunn study kind of showed there were people that had the amyloid plaques that didn't have any symptoms at all. And then, of course, there were some that did and definitely had symptoms. So how do you know if it even needs to be removed? When you've got that big, huge, major study out there, with that, that one always kind of just throws me for a loop on that. Any words of wisdom on that one to sort my pea brain out? Because I'm not a medical person.
Well, you know how to ask some extremely good questions. So these are not easy topics, right? So the biology is very complex. So it turns out that we know in a certain percentage of individuals with natural aging that there will be a percentage of individuals who have amyloid plaques. And the question is whether those amyloid plaques are contributing to the dementia in every circumstance. And the answer is not always. So I like to think of amyloid plaques as necessary but not sufficient for Alzheimer's disease. So Alzheimer's disease is really a clinical diagnosis. And so there are individuals with amyloid in their brain that don't go on to experience clinical Alzheimer's disease. And so in that case, what you have is likely a situation where there's other factors that are contributing to the dementia. So that could include things like vascular dementia. So that's a very common cause after Alzheimer's disease. Probably the next most common cause is when you have, let's say, poorly controlled hypertension or prior stroke or known to have vascular disease. We know that vascular health plays a super critical role in cognition, and that over time, people who have impaired cardiovascular health could be at risk of what we call vascular dementia. And in that case, imagine a situation where a person has cognitive decline And then there's some evidence of amyloid accumulation. So now the clinician has to evaluate that patient and say, like, do I think the root cause of the condition is being driven by the amyloid plaque pathology, or is it being driven by some other, like what we call co-pathology or other comorbidity? And oftentimes, you know, patients, all of us, you know, people are complex. So, you know, we don't come in with providing the clinician the answer. So it's like a constellation of signs and symptoms, and then a clinical presentation. And oftentimes it's like 70 years of living and exposure to all kinds of other factors that could potentially change our long-term, you know, cognitive health. And I think that that's really where it's so essential to recognize that these tests that are really good at looking at the pathological indicators of disease, whether it's PET scans or whether it's cerebrospinal fluid or whether it's blood testing, that the clinician has the job to look at all of the data, the patient's presentation, and possibly explore other forms of testing to say, do I think it's due to Alzheimer's or do I think it's due to something else? And that's the reason why none of these tests, regardless of whether it's PET scans, CSF, or blood testing, are standalone diagnostics. So it's important to recognize that, that just because one has a certain test result, that doesn't guarantee a diagnosis or no diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. It's just one important piece of data that goes into the clinician's evaluation of the patient to make that final diagnosis. I hope that helps. I don't know if I evaded the question.
Yeah, a little of both. But it's
a little of both, right?
It's a hard question. And like you said, everybody is a little bit different. And I've never heard, you know, that taus and plaques are great for our body, you know, so it's right. Something that it doesn't seem like we're going to miss necessarily either.
Yeah.
But I've just, you know, I just find it all fascinating on how different everybody is with this disease, even though we have to categorize to, you know, to try to help and improve health. I wanted to ask, in terms of the blood tests, how fast of a turnover is that to get results?
Yeah, so basically what happens is once the blood is drawn, and that blood can be obtained at the clinician's office, it can be obtained at, we have a partnership that affords patients access to patient service centers throughout the entire United States. And in that case, patients can actually go to our website and they can put in their geographic region on a little patient map that we have. And they could say, oh, where might there be a nearby patient service center to be able to get testing in a convenient location. We also have mobile phlebotomy. So we have, we allow, you know, in the event that a clinician and the patient decide this is a good decision for me to get the testing, that in fact, the patient can actually get the test performed in the comfort of their own home. So we'll have a mobile phlebotomist come out to their home and do the testing. And so then what happens is the plasma, the blood is collected, the plasma is sent to C2N diagnostics. Once it reaches our lab and we confirm that all the information has been filled out properly, et cetera, we then run it through our process. So we will report results back in no later than 10 days. And it's usually 10 business days. But the reality is that the majority of our reports are read out in 5 days. And so, you know, it's just you wind up getting a distribution depending on what's happening in the lab in any given day. And so patients will have those results in a very short period of time, anywhere from, let's say, 2 to 3 days out to 10 days. And so what happens is once we get the result, we will then fax or send, communicate the result, test result to the clinician. And then the clinician now has that information that they then speak to the patient. And sometimes the patient is going to come in for another visit, and it might be a sit-down visit or in some cases, perhaps telehealth. But in most cases, I think many of the clinicians that are using these blood tests or CSF or PET scans, they want to have FaceTime with the patient because it's such an important piece of information. And they want to be able to talk to the patient about, like, okay, this is how to think about the test result and what it means for your overall care. And then now let's start thinking about what we can do with that. I mean, in the case of a negative test, then that certainly could provide some assurances and a lot of comfort that it's not likely to be Alzheimer's disease. And then that might prompt the clinician to say, okay, let's start thinking about other potential causes, some of which could be reversible entirely. And then if it is positive, you say, well, then there's a high likelihood of amyloid or Alzheimer's disease pathology. We now need to think about what's next. And maybe that's additional testing, or maybe it's starting to think about a treatment plan and then really put it in the context, those results, for what to do next. But, you know, that communication is so vital. And so, but the logistics of just getting the test result usually happens in a pretty short period of time.
Okay. What about the cost factor compared to like a PET scan? You know, I mean, because everyone's worried about, you know, dementia just draining the budgets and things. And I mean, with our boomers, which I'm one of, you know, there's a ton of us coming up and those dollars are going to be clawed at more and more. Is it more efficient cost-wise for a blood test versus a PET scan?
Yeah, so great question. So I think that the way we look at costs and the way we think about value to the system, there's multiple components to that. So I think that, you know, generally speaking, when you look at modalities that are currently kind of represent the standards of care for patients, and historically, you know, it has been cerebral spinal fluid analysis or amyloid PET scans. You tend to have tests that are actually quite costly. So, you know, when we think about cost, there's cost to patients, and then there's cost to the system, and there's cost to even the providers when they're providing the testing. And so, you know, obviously the most important constituent there is the patient. And so thinking about what the patient out-of-pocket cost is. And so that's obviously where, you know, the system is heavily reliant upon a positive reimbursement system that allows for helping patients to get their needed medical technologies covered and for them to be able to access. And so right now, they're actually for all the testing modalities, there are not formal coverage policies by many of the payers. And that the good news is that that's all in evolution. So that's changing as clearly there's, you know, a growing demand and availability of disease modifying therapies that can change the trajectory of Alzheimer's disease. And so you've got, you know, the patient out of pocket costs, and then you have the payer costs. And then again, you have the system costs. And so when we look at the costs of like amyloid PET scans, those can run anywhere from $3,000 to $5,000, upwards of $10,000. And so I give you a broad range because it turns out that there's a lot of variability depending on region throughout the U.S. where the person might be getting their care. You could get a different cost if you go to one hospital. It could be a different cost if you go to a different system. And so there's a lot of variables that go into the cost of these technologies. So in the case of our test, and then in the case of cerebral spinal fluid, you know, there those test costs do tend to be less expensive than imaging. But even in that case, you have the out-of-pocket patient costs, which, you know, can range anywhere from a couple hundred dollars up to $1,000. And then you have some situations where you've got the clinicians and the system is having to provide the testing environment, which means having a couple of practitioners. So usually a clinician and then an ancillary support staff member to be available for when the procedure is performed. You also need to have the testing or the lumbar puncture performed in a procedure room. So you've got utilization of expensive infrastructure. So when you start looking at the costs of that total experience, you wind up getting into, you know, could be $1,000 up to $3,000. And so when you look at our blood test, our list price for the Precivity AD test is $1,250. The list price for the Precivity AD2 test is $1,450. And then that's the list price. And so then, you know, C2N has a financial assistance program that is accessible for patients to learn more about on the Precivity AD website. But what we really try to do is to not have finances be a burden for the patient. And so that's kind of some of the rationale behind financial assistance. And then, as you can imagine, you know, one of our top priorities at C2N Diagnostics is to build the clinical evidence to show the real value of this test to be able to help in the patient experience and the clinician experience to provide a better overall care process for the patient. And you provide that evidence to the payers like Medicare, who then evaluate the strength and quality of your evidence to then make a decision on reimbursement. And so that is an active process for us. We are going through a very vigorous and rigorous process of building all that evidence and then submitting data to the payers that we know will ultimately be responsible for handling the coverage. And, you know, we want to be responsible there because you want to make sure that the payers are getting good value for what you're providing. And you also want the patients to get good value and you want the health system to get good value. And interestingly, at the most recent international meeting that occurred for Alzheimer's disease, known as CTAD, Clinical Trials in Alzheimer's Disease, that was in Boston a couple of weeks ago, our team actually presented really interesting data around the cost savings and budget impact of providing our first generation tests. So we have not yet done that work for the second generation test, but it turns out that if in fact one was to use the Precivity AD blood test in 40% of patients who would qualify for getting the test, we could talk a little bit about who qualifies to get the test in a moment. It turns out that you actually wind up saving about $600 per patient per test. And so when you look at high level savings for the overall impact at like the societal level, or you look at from a payer perspective and you have many, many individuals in your plan who may be, you know, needing a test like this, it turns out that actually you can have a very robust cost savings to the system by using blood testing. And so we think that, you know, we've provided a test that does deliver high value to all the stakeholders, including the patients first and foremost, and then the payers as well as to society. I hope that helps.
Do you see the blood tests replacing like the PET scans? But I also know in other, you know, disease areas, you'll do this and then you'll get a backup of that and stuff too.
Yeah, great question. So our first generation test, it turns out that when you have a very high APS value or very low APS value, again, at the end of the day, it's the clinician's decision on what to do next for the patient. But we know some clinicians who will use that information to then start treating patients. And so we've seen with data that we've actually published that, in fact, when the clinicians get a very high value or a low value, that, in fact, they start prescribing certain treatments. If a person doesn't have disease, they actually take people off of the drug because the patient didn't need the drug in the first place. And so we know that it improves medication decision-making. And then we see that oftentimes patients aren't going on for additional testing. Now, the second generation test is an interesting one because the quality of that test is so high that in a number of studies, including some data that's been recently published, we can actually show that our test actually has very comparable performance to identifying amyloid pathology when compared against cerebrospinal fluid or amyloid PET. And so we think, again, this represents a vital tool and in some cases could certainly serve as an alternative to PET and CSF, but that's not really our decision to make. It's usually the clinician. They take that information. They say, okay, I've got a result and I'm, you know, convinced that this is the result I need to start now going ahead with the next treatment decision step for the patient. Or maybe in some cases, they have to go ahead and get additional testing. It's like any other aspect of clinical medicine where clinician looks at the tools available to them and they say, well, I think I've got enough information now to make treatment decision. Or in some cases, they want to get more information.
Okay. The other thing I was wondering is when people get the tests, one of my pet peeves is people go to the doctor, okay, they get a diagnosis, and then they don't really get any support. they get a prescription, they get another appointment, they get maybe another test lined up, but they don't really get locked into everyday practical support. Do you guys, and given the APO, I can never say it right, APO, is it E4?
The APOE genotype information.
Yeah. Are they doing any, you know, genetic counseling or even just supportive counseling, you know, with this? I know some clinics had started it and during the pandemic, it kind of fell away, but families really, really need to get connected to support. And a diagnosis is fine. And, you know, the medical information is important, but so is the day-to-day survival of how do I live with these symptoms. Do you see any of that changing in the near future? Are you hearing any talk on that? Because I just think it is so critical if we're really going to make progress, because if you match those two together, our patients are going to do much better. So are our families.
Absolutely. It's a wonderful question. And I think you've touched on an extremely important topic that we could spend another hour discussing. I think that as the tools for both diagnosis and treatment get better and better, clearly there's going to need to be an infrastructure that supports all these individuals who could be afflicted by the disease. And obviously that's something that's been a need for a long time. But I think it's particularly germane now because what we're seeing is because these tools can become so accessible. I mean, blood testing is universally accessible. You know, amyloid PET scans are really restricted to the specialized centers. And we know that like 60 million Americans don't even have any access to specialized facilities where they can even explore like advanced imaging techniques to be able to get a diagnosis. And so there's a great deal of need for building that support system, both within clinicians and then ancillary support from other service providers to help provide that patient with the experience, the kind of care support that they need. And I think that we're seeing C2Ns involved in a lot of implementation science projects with academicians and community investigators throughout the U.S. and even the world, where we're looking at ways we can improve communication, ways we can help better educate, and ways that we can help provide not just the testing result or let's say a treatment, but like a more comprehensive care experience. And I think you're going to see a tremendous commitment to that in the years ahead. Now, we do currently suffer as a healthcare system from significant shortages. There's not enough neurologists to take care of all these patients. Primary care is going to play a really vital role in that partnership between the neurologist specialist and then the primary care clinician. And we know that if we can equip them with the tools needed to provide that kind of quality care, I think we could start to see neurodegeneration start to get managed in some ways, thinking about it as truly just a chronic disease, the way we manage like hypertension or a person who's experienced a heart attack or, you know, early stage heart failure, that we've got tools that we can equip with the primary care provider to help them care for that patient longitudinally. And I think that will be an essential component. We're seeing a big commitment to that. So I think you'll see a lot in the years ahead.
Well, I hope it really expands outside the medical field because they don't have all the answers. They never are.
Absolutely.
And if they don't include the families and the people living with it and the experiential side, we're really slowing down the progress. I mean, I've seen that. That's what drew me into this to begin with. And, you know, we created a thing called Dementia Map, which we would love to have you guys be part of, that has 150 categories people can search. We're not putting people in that don't know they're there because we want people that are actually going to respond. But there are so many services, products, and tools to support people that nobody knows about because nobody can compete with, you know, the advertising costs and things that are there. And one of the biggest components to me, and it's getting some attention, I still don't, and again, I'm not a medical person, but I don't think it's still getting the level of attention it needs, is just that social support, taking away that isolation, that loneliness. You know, you remove the depression from the patient and the family, that alone is a big boost. in terms of care, and being able to not feel, you know, so alone and isolated. And I think, you know, I would really like to see that incorporated, because I think together we can do so much better. Everyone kind of focusing on their own entities instead of, I still think we're very siloed in many ways, but we do have to wrap up the show. This has just been a fascinating conversation. We've been talking with Dr. Braunstein, who is the CEO and president of C2N Diagnostics, specializing in these blood tests called Percepty. And they are really bringing clarity and some good accuracy in terms of diagnosis for Alzheimer's disease, which is very, very exciting, in a non-invasive way to boot, which is really cool too. And so you can go to their website. You can go to percivityad.com. You can find them on Twitter and Facebook at C2N Diagnostics. And again, thank you so much for your time today. This has been really, really helpful. Appreciate it very much, Joel.
Thank you, Lori. It was a real pleasure to be here. And anytime we can collaborate, count me in.
Sounds like a plan. Thank you. And to our listeners, again, we urge you to go to AlzheimerSpeaks.com. Check out all of our free educational resources. We've been pulling them together since 2009. That's what they're there for. You will hear the voice of the true experts, those living with Alzheimer's disease, what works for them, what doesn't. Many interviews that we do, both audio and video. We have people who can participate in our Dementia in the Arts. You can learn about dementia-friendly communities, as well as memory cafes and so much more. And you can also access from their dementia map. And don't forget to check out our book, Betty the Bald Chicken, Lessons in How to Care. It's a great children's book, but it's good for any age, and it can be read on one-to-one individually or groups or big conferences. So have a wonderful week, and know together we're better. Pass this show on. Bye-bye.
Hi, this is Suzanne Newman, host of the Answers for Elders podcast and radio show. We are the North Star that guides you through the complicated journey of senior care with trusted experts in money, law, living solutions, and more. So join us on this station, your favorite podcast channel, or just go to AnswersForElders.com. Meet the Wayshowers who will help your journey a lot easier.